Greetings, I'm Keith Klein, the host of the VentureFizz podcast, where I interview the most fascinating people in the tech scene. This is episode 328, and today's guest is Ellen Chiesa, partner at Bold Start Ventures. Back in 2016, we wrote a profile about Ellen on VentureFizz when she was leading product management at Lola.com. The profile was part of a series that we call Driven, which I think is a very fitting word to describe Ellen. And ironically, the discussion around considering a role in venture capital actually came up, so in my opinion, it was only a matter of time. From being part of a winning team in high school for the first robotics competition, to starting a company in college, to a career path in product management, to leading a company that was developing a new programming language, Ellen has built the perfect core foundation for a successful career as an investor. Bold Start is a venture capital firm that is your partner from inception for developer-first infrastructure and SaaS founders working to help turn your idea into a category-creating iconic company. The firm's portfolio includes companies like Sneak, Customer, Big ID, Superhuman, and many more. In this episode of our podcast, we cover lots of great topics, like a conversation of what makes a great product manager, Ellen's background, including the story of taking some time off to build an edtech startup with her other classmates while in college at the Olin School of Engineering, working on early mobile initiatives at Microsoft, then joining Kickstarter as a product manager, and what led her to pursue her MBA at Harvard Business School, meeting serial entrepreneur Paul English and leading product at Lola.com, a travel app, developing a new programming language for her startup called Dark with Paul Bigger, which allows companies to build software faster, plus what this experience taught her in terms of leading a company and getting adoption with the developer community, the future of AI-developed code, how she landed in venture capital at Bold Start, including what she is targeting for investments, and what has been her biggest surprise as a VC, startup pitch advice, and so much more. Okay, quick side note. Did you know that you can now watch our podcast interviews on YouTube? Head over to youtube.com/venturefizz to access our channel, and from there, you'll find a library of content, including a podcast playlist. And while you're at it, make sure you click on that subscribe button. Okay, without further ado, here's my interview with Ellen. Ellen, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to reconnect after so many years.
Oh my God, I am so excited to reconnect because we were just talking about this, but I did want to mention it in the podcast. Like, I actually am very grateful to have this conversation because many, many, many years ago, we did a profile on you when you were the head of product at Lola. And we were just starting to do these like employee profiles, and VentureFizz was becoming more of a content engine for employment branding. And it was that profile that was that helped us transition to a series that's part of our diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives called Lead Her. And it profiles women in leadership roles in the tech industry. And I think that Driven series was our catalyst to get to what we do now. So I want to thank you for that early inspiration.
I'm so glad I was able to be part of that. I feel like it's really fun. I like, even as a VC now, I love reading profiles about operators at various companies who are like just working on cool problems and hearing how they think about it and how they got drawn to that market. I feel like people sometimes underestimate how much fun it is to hear from leaders who aren't necessarily just founders.
Yep, exactly. So when I was reading that profile, it just brought me back to, of course, how I think about you. Obviously, you're a venture capitalist now, but you have such a foundation in product management and a thought leader in that category. So I thought it would make sense to start the conversation by talking about product management and what makes a great product manager.
Yeah, this is actually, it's been really humbling for me lately. We hired an operating partner at Bold Start who's also a career product person, Anna Debenham. And so just watching how she operates in product has been a great reminder about the things great product managers do well. I think there's a real curiosity that is an important part of the role. You have to have a hypothesis about what you want to do and why, but you have to be genuinely curious and be willing to take input from everyone else to continue to refine that, be that your teammates are helping figure out what to build, be that your customer set, be that partners. And so I think that curiosity and humility is definitely a huge part of a great product manager. And then I think the other part is just the inclination to get things done. And just kind of say, like, we're never going to have perfect information. We just have to keep moving as a company. And especially in an early stage startup, you have such limited time and such limited capital and such a limited team. Like, you just have to start going and keep going and be decisive about it.
Yeah, absolutely. No, it's and it's we're going to talk about your professional journey, which I think is also important of people learning how to get from A to B in product management, because it's not like you graduate from college with a degree in product management. There's different ways that people end up in that profession.
Yes, yes, definitely.
Well, let's rewind the clock and talk about your background story. So where did you grow up? What were you like as a child?
I was a very nerdy child. I grew up in southeastern Michigan. Most people like know it as car companies like Chrysler and Ford and GM were all right near where I was. And I think most parents of kids around me worked at car companies. My parents didn't happen to. But yeah, I was always very interested in science and math. There was a period of time where I thought I wanted to be an astrophysicist. Didn't pan out. But my friend who also wanted to be an astrophysicist became a director of the space station at NASA. So definitely
What?
something going on in Michigan
Okay.
at that time. But I got really into robotics when I was in high school and spent a lot of time in the first robotics program. I really think of it as being very analogous to products, where like you have 6 weeks to learn about a brand new game, figure out how you want to play that game, like very strategy level, which I think is a big part of the product job, then kind of move into the design phase and design a robot to play the game in that way, and then time to like actually manufacture and build. And so like it's a very much end-to-end project-based sort of philosophy. And I think that's really stuck with me throughout my whole career.
And didn't you were part of a team that actually won the championship for the first robotics competition, right?
We did. I was very lucky that my high school won the best high school in the country, and we won a world robotics championship in the first year.
Wow,
And I
that's
was
so
there.
cool.
This had nothing to do with me. I mean, I was a small part of being there, but like it was very much like I just happened to be at that school at the right moment.
Okay, so then you went on to study electrical and computer engineering. So what was it about Olin College of Engineering that brought you there?
I loved Olin so much. I think for me, what it was in high school, I had this whole project-based education. And I also had friends who were a couple years older than me and went to engineering programs at other great schools. And I saw that so much of what they did was they would go to a big lecture with 200 people, and then they would get a problem set, and then they'd be up at midnight working on this problem set alone. And in contrast, Olin has a program called Candidates Weekend, where when you're admitted, you actually go and you're with a bunch of other people and you're building projects together while you're there. And for me, it was really saying, hey, I don't want to be sitting alone doing these problem sets. Just like I love math, but I don't want to be sitting alone doing math all the time. I want to be doing practical things and working in an interdisciplinary fashion like I did on this robotics team. And that was 100% what Olin was about. It was also that when I went to Olin, the school was still unaccredited, which I think some people's parents wouldn't have been so on board with. But my parents have always been very supportive of some of the strange choices I have made. And it was brand new. And I really liked this idea of I'm not just getting an education, I'm also helping to build what the future of engineering education might be for other people.
But one thing that you did that I thought was very forward thinking was you took some time off to pursue an idea in ed tech during your studies.
Yes, this was another time my parents were quite understanding, but five of my friends and I, we'd done 2 years at Olin, an Olin very forward thinking institution, but we were all kind of like, hey, we want to like actually make something, not just be going to class. We think we'll know a little bit more what we want to learn in class after we try to work and not just in an internship context, try to like really build something for ourselves. And so we all teamed up together. We rented a house. We lived together. We worked together all the time. And we were all very passionate about education, as you might guess, being at Olin. And at the time, we felt like most ed tech wasn't really oriented around users. And a big theme at Olin is user-oriented design. And so we tried to rebuild a CMS from the ground up for middle schoolers based on what we thought would help them learn. And so we thought about a lot about the role of parents and how they should be adding resources, not just checking grades. We thought about teachers and how they're kind of sometimes deluged with content from helicopter parents and a better way to funnel that energy. We thought about actually one of the big things I think about now is how all software is collaborative by default. And when we're working in an online product, we're usually working together. At the time we were working on Alight Learning, you had limited numbers of computers in computer labs in schools. And so we invented a way for two students to be logged in to the same workstation so they could both get credit for the work they were doing. So we were like, we were just thinking about like a lot of novel forward-looking stuff in edtech. It's a really challenging market, but I think we all learned a ton about like what it takes to build a business, what it takes to build software, and it was a great experience.
Yeah, and I mean, I have to give a plug. So if anyone listening to this and is in the Boston area and looking to hire engineers, like this school is phenomenal. It's in Needham, right? Is that
It's in
what's,
Needham, yeah.
Yeah. So here, I just think everybody on the West Coast knows about it. Like Google's there, Microsoft's there, like recruiting on campus, right? Like all the startups in Boston need to be there.
That's the other one. All the startups in Boston should be there. I'm also always like recruiting parents of high school aged kids to be like, hey, this probably isn't on the list you got of like the best 10 schools, just because it's a little bit, it would if you got 10 engineering schools. But if you're just kind of looking at like a list of Ivies and the big public schools that are great, like those are all great schools. But for the right profile of student, Olin, I think, is the best place.
All right. So what did you do next?
Okay. After that, went back to Olin because we'd all kind of said, hey, like we're going to learn what we want to learn. We're going to go back to learn it. Graduated in 2010 and got a really cool opportunity to join the Office Mobile team right when Microsoft had decided they were going to make Office Mobile for devices other than Windows phones. And so we had this partnership with Nokia, and we were working directly with them to build special Office experiences on top of Nokia smartphones. And so this was when like Nokia was a huge operator. RIM and BlackBerry was a big concern. iPhones were starting to be a thing. But I remember like charts we had where like Android wasn't even on the table, which it's only been almost 15 years now. But like that's a really fast change for a market. And it really happened in those 2 years I was there.
Yeah, that was fascinating. So you're reminding me. So I was flying back from Florida recently, and on the in-flight entertainment, they had that BlackBerry movie. So I'm like, oh, this is interesting. So I watched that, and that was just fascinating to see how that trajectory of the company, and then obviously the iPhone comes out, and they're just like, no way, no way, that's ridiculous. And obviously the rest is history, but it was a pretty interesting story. So what did Microsoft teach you kind of like coming out of, you know, school?
Oh, man, a lot of things. So for sure, I learned a lot about like the fundamentals of building good software. One of like the struggles we had at Alight Learning was there was one point where we lost user data because we did something bad to our database. I don't remember exactly what it was, but like that's clearly unacceptable for building software. And so like there was a lot around quality and how do you ship and release things well. And so there were a lot of technical skills I learned. And I think that is one of the valuable things about going to a big institution that does things well. I think I learned a lot about markets and just how fallible companies are and how fast things can change with watching what happened to BlackBerry and to Nokia and to others in that time period. And then I also think I learned a lot about myself and how I work. And to some extent, we started off on the product thing. I think the job of being a product manager at a large company and a small company are quite different. And At a small company, it's really valuable to just be driving forward, making decisions, just going. And like, I very much like come into a room and I'm like, let's go, let's do stuff. I want to move. And in big companies, there's a lot more of, hey, we have a lot of complicated stakeholder relationships. We need to get everyone on board. We need to work through this. We need to keep everyone in the loop through status mails. And that just wasn't something I was great at. Like, I just didn't have the patience for it. And so I think I learned a lot about environments in which I thrive and don't. And I think that's something that's really important for early career people to do.
All right. Well, that kind of tells the tale of going from large Microsoft to, at the time, you went to Kickstarter, but at the time, what size was it, like stage of the company at that point?
Yeah. So when I joined Kickstarter, I was the 50th employee. So it was a nice number. But 50 is very much, we were in a building on the Lower East Side and we had three floors. And so there was one like floor where we all hung out together, one that was like the community and project team, and one that was the engineering and product and design team. And so you can kind of think of it as being everyone on the product and engineering team was in one room together, that scope of company, like enough to have a little bit of coordination and kick off projects, but not that much. Like if you want to talk to someone, you walk over to their desk and talk to them. No question is very hard to answer at that point. And then company scale wise, that was sort of in the era where Kickstarter was first starting to have $1 million projects. So I think it was the time where when I started working there, people were kind of like, what's that? I've never heard of this. But obviously now I feel like it's part of the zeitgeist. It's hard to find someone who hasn't heard of Kickstarter and works in the tech industry.
So back when like Pebble like had their crazy run. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That time period. And Double Fine was one of them. I think Pebble and Double Fine were two of the first, and Elevation Dock, which was an iPhone dock. But yeah, there were a bunch of those like early projects that started catching, and it was really cool to see it would go from sector to sector. So some of the first big ones were in movies and technology, and then there started being really big comics projects and really big board game projects. And it was just neat to see different creative communities adopt Kickstarter like that.
All right. So you went back to school, you went to B school at HBS. So what prompted your decision to get your MBA?
Yeah. Man, I feel like my career has been so long now. I remember at the time, everything's been so short and like I needed more experiences. So I applied to HBS while I was still at Olin. And sort of my line of thinking was I went to this like brand new way out there engineering school. I kind of like, I'm interested in having exposure to a completely different way of thinking. I think of a lot of things as like how many lenses or how many tools can you kind of add to your belt from different disciplines. And so I was like, yeah, HBS, like, it's a cool place. They'd come to Olin to say, hey, we have this new program. You can apply now and come in 2 years. And I was like, there's no downside here. I think this is like a really interesting thing to consider. I applied, I was admitted. And so I had deferred again to be able to work at Kickstarter because I really wanted to work there. And so when I kind of came to the end of my deferral time, I thought about it in terms of what would I regret the most? Or like, if I'm thinking about this from the end of my life and I'm like 80 or 100, what would I have rather done? And I was like, yeah, I want to go see what HBS is all about. It's such like an interesting institution. And so I think for me, it was probably more about that than it was specifically about having an MBA as a credential.
Okay, so how did you meet Paul English?
Oh, yeah. So I did my first year at HBS. Definitely, it's a super interesting place. I'm pretty introverted. It doesn't always come across when I'm talking to people, but like it's definitely small talk is not usually my thing. It's a like huge, high energy place. And I was kind of like, okay, like, I don't know what I want to do for the summer. I think that was the first time VC started coming up for me where people were like, well, maybe you want to do a VC thing. And I was very on the fence about it. Didn't think I would like it. But then Youngmi Moon, who's a professor at HBS, was like, hey, I know this guy, Paul English. He's hiring for interns who will be EIRs and like start companies in an incubator over the summer. Why don't like you go talk to him about it? And originally, I think he wanted to hire two because they had two existing projects. And he found two of my classmates, Casey and Hanada, to run those two. And then he was like, I just like you and you're weird. Why don't you just come and we'll like figure out a new project? And I was like, okay. And then he was kind of like, how about you start on Monday? And I was like, I'm still supposed to finish class for another month. And he was like, yeah, we'll just do it at the same time. We'll just like get going. So we have something to hit the ground running with. And like, I love that about Paul. I think like Paul and I both have that, like a lot of like, all right, we're going to do it. Let's just be doing it.
Do it. Why wait?
It was awesome.
Yeah. And this is when he had Blade.
Yes. Yeah, so I was an intern at Blade, and the thing I started working on when we were kind of like, do anything, it's actually really topical now. That was in the last wave of everyone being like, everything's going to be chatbots. I think we have a little more foundational technology now, but we started exploring the general chatbot space and the future of that interface. And then what became clear was that to be effective with the limitations of technology, then you would want to be more specified to a vertical. And obviously, Paul English founded Kayak, so if you're going to pick a vertical that he has an unfair advantage in, we decided it made a lot of sense to be thinking about travel. And we also realized that travel has the great duality of humans are always very involved in it. It's great to talk to someone else about their experience and have a human really thinking through preferences. And the technical back end side of booking travel is actually quite complex and you need pretty complicated workflow tools for the humans who are doing things. And so it seemed like exactly the right opportunity for the technology that was happening and the team Perfect. That we had.
Yeah, yeah, no, it definitely made a lot of sense. So what ended up happening? Like how far did you get the business or?
Yeah, Lola's a great story. So we were doing general purpose chat-based travel for everyone. Then we realized that the people who Lola really resonated with were business travelers for the most part. And I think it's just like the type of help you want when you say, I'm going to go on my honeymoon for 3 weeks around all of Europe is like, it's quite a broad and expansive problem. And it can be hard to solve that well for someone you're not working with person to person all the time. Whereas, hey, I go down to New York once a month. I like to fly out Sunday night. These are like the hotels and neighborhoods I like to stay in. You can like get a pretty good rapport with someone and help it be really effective. And then they realized around that time I left to start my next company, Dark, which we can talk about later. But after they'd really focused in on the business traveler market, they then realized they could expand into spend management because a lot of expense policy is really around travel expenses for people. And so that was around when Mike Volpe came in and joined Lola as CEO, and they were able to broaden out into spend management, particularly also important when people weren't traveling as much during the pandemic. And so they went then down that route and then ended up being acquired by Capital One. And so yeah, I think a bunch of the team is still at Capital One.
Yeah, ended up being a great story.
Yeah.
All right. So I did want to talk to you about your company, Dark. So I'm not an engineer and I just always get fascinated. I'm like, how does someone develop a new programming language? I'm just like, how do you even like start with that? And just whoever created Basic or, you know, all the, like, Java. It's just like, what, how do you create that to actually do what it does? It just blows my mind.
I think, like, okay, I think for people who enjoy writing software, it's well worth thinking about how to create a language. I think there's kind of two pieces of it. And I definitely came from one side. My co-founder, who's also named Paul, it's a little confusing. I'll try to use this full name, Paul Bigger, to make sure we're differentiated. But so the side I came from is, like, I'd worked at all of these technology companies and I'd worked in product. And I always felt a little bit like my job was so important because it's so tedious to write code. And so you have to think a lot about user validation up front. You have to make sure you've, like, scoped everything appropriately because it takes so long to deliver good software because of the tools engineers have available to them. And I think the level of quality with which we build tools for software developers never quite meets the level of quality that we build software for, like, information workers or lay people or consumers. And so that was something where I was like, okay, I really want it to be easier to make software, both because then all these companies could build software faster. And I also just personally am very motivated by the idea of all of us being like, you should be able to make software if you want to. If you have an idea for, hey, I'd be able to host my podcast better if I just had this little tool that could do whatever, like, I would love for you just be able to make that right away. So that was where I was coming from. My co-founder, Paul Bigger, he had previously founded CircleCI, which is a continuous integrations company. And so his kind of fundamental, and he's a PhD in compilers by background, was sort of like, hey, how can we get this cycle even closer together where we go from people are writing code and it's, like, real and live rather than having this big gap between where you're building things and where they actually live once you've built them. And so kind of putting those two things together, we came up with a vision for what was the language and the editor and the infrastructure such that you were always writing code that did exist in production and you were only writing code that was valid and you wouldn't be breaking anything while you were doing it. The really cool thing about it that impacted end users was this meant you could basically write software backwards. So instead of saying, I'm going to write a bunch of code and then it will run, you could say, hey, I want to be able to submit a form. And you could just, like, submit the form and then say, great, now that I have this data, this is what I want to do with it. The classic application I always demoed was building an office sign-in where you say, like, okay, pretend someone who has arrived at your office and they have signed in. Okay, now that you know that they're here, you want to, like, parse out their name and you want to say, like, okay, who are they here to see? Let me send an email to that person to say they've arrived, which is quite different than going system first and saying, like, okay, I'm going to build an email messaging service. And so it was a very pragmatic way to think about programming, or a very end user application oriented way of thinking about writing code instead of just, like, a code first or tech way of writing code.
So, like, getting started, like at what point did you raise capital and, like, what was that process like?
Yeah, it's super interesting to reflect on this now having sat on the other side of the table as well. So we raised capital very early on. I feel lucky that we were able to do that. Like, that's partially because of Paul's previous success with CircleCI. I also had been a product leader before. And so sort of the further you are in your career, I think in some ways it can be easier to raise capital a bit earlier. We also did that because we knew we were building a bunch of deep backend technology and that it was going to take a little bit longer than, say, if you're just building something that is quite similar to software that already exists. And so we raised a seed round of $3.5 million in the summer of 2017.
Got it. Okay. And then you started to build a team and build it, like, so did you, like, as far as getting adoption with the developer community, like, what was that process like?
Yeah. This was something we also did a little bit differently. And I think there's, like, always interesting tactics that come up at different times, and we can kind of think of them all as tools that are appropriate to some companies. But so we spent almost a year just building core platform and building things in Dark ourselves. Just there was, like, a big technological hurdle to get going. And then when we were thinking about our first user, we wanted someone who's building a serious application, not just a toy. And so we hired a customer off of Hacker News. We made a little job description. And we didn't pay him an engineer salary. We just paid him a monthly stipend. So you can kind of think of it as non-dilutive funding for his startup. And he came to our office every single day and he would sit there programming in Dark, where one of us sat there with him if he got stuck on anything and someone else sat there fixing bugs as he found them. And so, like, he was, like, his name's Daniel. He was, like, really, like, really felt like part of the team. Like, Daniel is so much of a part of the story of Dark. And then after that went well, we then did the same thing with another early user, much lower stipend, much lower commitment because the platform works a lot better, named Chase. And so Chase is also a part of the early story of Dark. And so we kind of kept going in that way until we felt comfortable letting more and more users into the platform and knew there was enough there.
So like, as you were talking about what you were building and like, I don't know if this is accurate or not. So if you're like, nope, that doesn't make sense. So like with OpenAI, it just opens your mind to possibilities of what can happen. So was like, you kind of envisioned like telling OpenAI, I want to build this and it's just going to create an application and you don't have to code it, right? Like,
yep. Yeah, this is like really, I don't want to say I'm eating my hat, but like I definitely had a belief of how we were going to get to everyone writing code, where I was kind of like, okay, we used to have like machine language and assembly, and then we had C, which was a little higher level, and then we got Python, which was a lot more readable, and then we like maybe have things like Dart, and then maybe we have something on top of that that like looks more like a Zapier. And what we're definitely seeing in the market now is we're seeing a lot of innovation at both ends of that. And I'm not sure where we end up netting out, but you have things like Copilot, where engineers suddenly have much better autocomplete, which was also something we cared about a lot in Dark. And so that's very the low level of taking existing software engineers and helping make them more effective. But we also have things like Vercel V0, where you can basically describe a SaaS application and it builds it for you. And obviously it's not like 100% there yet. And usually the, like, I think people today will run into problems with AI generated code the same way they run into like limitations of low code platforms, where you suddenly want to do one thing that the product's not really built for, and then you're kind of like stuck and you can't do it. But yeah, it definitely seems like we might get to something where people build and then tweak applications without having to learn anything about code.
All right, well, you had a great background as a product manager, but this was the first time as a founder and CEO. So what did that experience teach you?
I think I was lucky. Paul Baker and I used to joke about this a lot. I was very fortunate as a first-time founder to have spent the time at Lola from so early on. There aren't very many opportunities, especially as a product person, that you get to see things from day zero of the company. And so I think that was fortunate. And Lola in particular grew so quickly that I kind of went through a lot of stages in a very short period of time. But I think being a founder, I mean, being at Lola, everyone wants to work for Paul English. It's like, it's a great thing to do. If you get the chance to work for Paul English, like it's really fun and really interesting and like very fast paced. And I think the difference is not everyone at the time I started Dark wanted to work for Ellen Schiessa, or the people who were excited and knew me by background knew me from working on things like Kickstarter and Lola, which is quite different to working on a programming language. And so I think I learned a ton about hiring and how to think about hiring. I now definitely encourage founders I work with now that if you're thinking about fundraising, you should definitely pre-wire those first hires where like you've already talked to the people you want to be working with and be like, hey, I'm going to start this. When I raise money, is this something you want to be working on with me? And I think like that's an important signal for you as a founder. And it also just enables you to like hit the ground running as soon as you've raised capital, if you want to. So definitely a bunch about hiring. I think it's also how easy it is as a founder to get stuck in the same problem for a little while because you're kind of in your head and you're working on it every single day. And so like one of those with Dark, for instance, the text editor we had was very structured. And that's like, that specifically isn't a thing so much as just, it's a little different than the text editors most engineers are used to using. And I kept trying to do like very clever things to get around this problem where I'd be like, oh, I'll pair with people and that'll get some people in, or, oh, I'll like teach people, I'll write better docs, I'll do this, I'll do that. And I spun my wheels a lot just trying to make little changes to like fix a problem where I should have just gone ahead at the problem and like, oh, this structured editor format as is isn't going to work. We've got to try something else. And so I think as a founder, it's really important to have people who you trust that you're having regular touch points with who can kind of help you go like, hey, you've been saying the same thing for the last like few months here. Are we really making progress on this or do we need to look at it a different way?
Got it. All right, let's talk about what you're up to now as a venture capitalist at Bold Start. So what led you down the path of becoming a VC and joining the team there?
Yeah, I feel like this is a common thing. I think a lot of VCs are like, I didn't intend to be a VC and yet somehow I ended up here. For me, it was that Bold Start had invested in Dark. And so after I transitioned out, I was just kind of generally catching up with my partners Ed and Elliot and Shomik like once a month, just kind of chatting about ideas, what I might do next, how things were going. And eventually we just kind of got to the point where everyone was like, yeah, we all like working on the same things. We all like collaborating together. We know like, and they knew I wasn't sure what I wanted to do next, but they're kind of like, well, why don't you come and we'll like figure out the right role for you once you're here. Maybe you'll want to start something else. Maybe you'll want to support the companies like with your product expertise and your experience being a former founder. At the time I was also angel investing already. So they're like, well, maybe like you like angel investing, maybe you actually would like being a VC. And so we left it very open-ended at the beginning so I could kind of have the leeway to figure it out within the environment with my teammates.
Got it. Okay. So that eventually evolved to where you're a partner now. So what are the details of Boldstar, just if people aren't familiar with the fund?
Oh, yeah. I sometimes forget to say this, which is very bad venture capitalist behavior. So at Boldstar, we like to say we invest at inception. We call it inception now because when we would say pre-seed to people, they would think the check was too smaller than what we might be able to do. And when we said seed, people would sometimes come too late. But we want to meet you before you're starting your company. So if anyone's out there who's an engineer who's like, oh, I want to be a founder someday, I've worked on this tool internally and I have an idea for how to generalize it to other people, or I have a problem I've run into before that I'm interested in solving. We want to be meeting people when they start thinking about the space they want to start starting a company in. Frequently, we're talking to people before they've incorporated, and then we're waiting for them to incorporate because we're so excited about what they want to do. So super early stage. And then in terms of space, we're an enterprise-focused fund. So pretty much all of our companies you can imagine someday selling into a large enterprise. And we have a very heavy technical bent. So I'd say 75 to 80% of what we do is somehow related to developer tooling, cybersecurity, or enterprise infrastructure. And so for me, that's great. Like coming from the side of building a programming language, I really like talking about products for technical people. And that's been a very good fit for me. And so we spend a lot of time on that. And we are very highly convicted. So our current fund is a little under $200 million, but we'll only invest in 25 companies as core companies within the fund. And so that means when we do rounds, we're usually leading. We usually offer to take the entire round and then we'll cut back as necessary if founders have another angel they want to work with or something like that. But kind of that can be a check size range of anywhere between 500,000 and say 5 million, depending on the round.
Okay. And then if you look at your website, like the portfolio includes companies like Sneak and Customer, Superhuman. So where have you been spending your time as far as investments that you've made?
Yeah. Yeah. So those are definitely some of the big ones that people have heard of, especially Sneak has a huge presence here in Boston. One company that I invested in that I'm really excited about is called LiveBlocks. And so the two founders worked together at Envision when Envision was trying to respond to Figma building a real-time collaborative design tool. And they learned firsthand how hard it is to build real-time collaborative experiences, but also just general collaboration experiences, like being able to add comments into a product. Because once you have comments, people expect threading, they expect emoji reactions, they expect notifications about the comments. Like there's a huge amount of depth in collaboration. And so they teamed up together and said, hey, we are going to build infrastructure so no engineers and designers have to go through what we went through. They should just be able to plug in and be able to have an API that lets them build collaborative experiences. And so that's just been a really great team to work with. I love designers as founders. I love engineers as founders. And I think sometimes you get really magical pairs of the two.
Very cool. No, that's a great idea. All right. Yeah. So how does somebody get on your radar? Like what's like, you know, people are usually like, oh, you know, intros are the best way, but like how does someone get that idea in front of you? And what do you expect out of like a first meeting?
Yeah. I mean, honestly, people can just email me. I'm just ellen@boldstart.vc. I do actually read all of my email. I think the other thing about it is I think it's different if you're, say, talking to a giant multi-stage fund who does a whole bunch of different types of companies. Usually if someone's emailing me, like, if you want to build a dev tool, there aren't that many people who are really excited about building developer tooling and infrastructure. It's like there's still a lot of us, but it's like a smaller space. And so if you're going to email me and it's a compelling idea as developer tooling, like, I'm going to answer. It's not hard to get to me in that way. There's no, like, you don't have to fly a balloon over my house or something. And so generally speaking, once I get to that point, like the big questions for us is just the venture model is like, it's a power law business. You're looking at businesses that have the potential to be huge. And so like one proxy I'll give people for that is you kind of want to be thinking about, is this market large enough that I could be making $100 million a year? Another one that can be like a little bit more tangible for engineers is like, if you think about like the leader or the product that you think of as being like the big iconoclast in your category today, what would you have to build such that you could someday acquire them? And like, I want people thinking in like that scope of hugeness. So that's one thing. The other one is just being really clear around the pain. And this might be like, I felt this pain at work. It might be, I saw my team feel this pain. It might be, hey, I had this customer base and they had this pain. But being able to say like, the person who feels this, like it's an individual engineer, they're a TypeScript engineer, they use this editor or whatever it may be, like something hyper-specific, what their problem is today and how this potential solution would fix it. And I don't believe that's going to stay the same forever. But I think having that discipline around why you're solving it and like what the problem is before you attack it is really important. And we can iterate from there. So it's sort of, for me, is this huge, what is your approach off the bat?
So there's usually like one of the hard things about being a venture capitalist is you have to say no a lot. And what, you know, there's easy ones. It's like, okay, this is not a fit for our stage, or this is not, you know, Inception. It's not a fit for the type of technology we would invest in. So there's easy disqualifiers. What are the ones that are really hard? Like when you kind of like, okay, this is in our space. I like these founders. What are the hard no's?
I feel like for me, the hard no's are always, there's something that the founder assumes is true about the world that I don't necessarily believe, or something where the founders are good and they're attacking a real problem, but I don't think the market is going to shape up the way they think it is. An easy example of this that happened recently, there was a company called Auth0 that built developer-focused authentication, so login buttons, and they were acquired by Okta. And after they were acquired, everyone was kind of like, great, okay, there's probably going to be, Okta's not usually known for its great user experience. It's like a very robust product, but it's not considered developer friendly the way Auth0 was. And so people kind of went, oh, there's like a space here to make a new developer friendly Auth service. And suddenly, I want to say I have a list of more than 10 of them, but like lots of really great, really well-qualified founders all kind of went against the same market at the same time. And for me, unless I've had a really long-standing relationships with someone, even if I had, it's hard to look at that and say like, yeah, this is likely to be a good outcome just because there isn't the differentiation between the products.
Do you see a lot of that now that you kind of have this lens of looking at all these different entrepreneurs and their ideas? Is there a lot more overlap than you thought there would be, or is there less of?
Well, that's a great, I would say it's bimodal. Like, I think you see a lot, and like, for instance, last summer when the LLM technology first came out, a lot of people wanted to use it to write better unit tests for developers. And so I saw a whole lot of that in a row. And then you'll also just see like one-offs where you like really only see one team approaching something in a specific way. I think it's less common to kind of see two of them, for instance. So I think you got like, and when you think about volume, if there's 10 people doing this, you see a lot of them. And then you see like 10 of people doing a one-off kind of thing. So I guess both more and less in some regards.
So what are you excited about? Like what areas of technology, like if somebody's thinking about something and that's, you know, kind of where your head is at these days?
That's a good question. I feel like I was saying earlier, I feel like we're really changing how we need to think about the future of how we're going to write software. So I'm interested in a lot of those ideas. I'm happy to hear how other people are thinking about it. That's definitely one big one. I've always spent a lot of time on APIs. I think APIs are like the lingua franca of the internet. I think they're very interesting. So anyone who's thinking about API tooling, I think that's a space I always spend a fair amount of time in. And I've actually been leaning more towards, in with my background in robotics, I've been thinking a little bit more about what we're going to need around robotics. Our team is distributed. So my partners are in Miami, San Francisco, and London. And so I think we also have like a much deeper like bio and climate and energy ecosystem here than we do in some other places. And so I'm kind of trying to start to think about ideas there. And obviously there'd still need to be some overlap with enterprise software. So that's like more of an exploratory process for me, but I'm very happy to hear from people who are thinking about those spaces as well.
All right. So what's been the biggest surprise about being a venture capitalist?
Oh, okay. Especially after having been a product person, being a venture capitalist, like there's four partners at our fund. We don't need like a whole complicated system to interact with each other. We can just call each other. And it's not like we're going to someday be 40 and I need to like set it up to scale. It's just sort of like an inherently not scalable thing. And I think that was like a big, like one of my superpowers is taking things and being like, okay, here's how we do this. Here's a whole system. And now I'm like, oh, I don't really like need that here. And that's okay. But it was definitely surprising to me. It shouldn't have been, but it was.
So I think you were on another podcast that I was listening to preparing for this. And then like one of the things that you think about with companies and efficiencies is there, you know, leaner teams, like you could do a lot before you raise a lot of money to scale, right? Like your inception, pre-seed, seed, right? So what are your thoughts there and how that will affect, you know, fundraising, the amount of capital you'll need? Will this lead to more bootstrapping, you know, if they can, you know, afford to pay their bills type of thing?
the macroeconomic climate in the public markets really shifted, where the multiples we're seeing for software companies and how they're valued, like we were seeing 100x in 2021 when the interest rates were really low. And now that's like really come back where you're seeing like 10 to 15. And that has real implications for how much capital gets deployed into earlier stage companies. And it kind of goes back because like if you're a Series D company and people are kind of like, oh, you might go public soon, they'll like think of your value as being approximately the same as your public market value. And so then if you back it out to a Series B, they'll kind of be like, is your revenue on track to grow enough that your value would be like a public company at your series, whatever. And like that goes all the way back to seed. And so I think it's just people are raising oftentimes more constrained amounts of capital to do what they want to do because it's less available than it was a couple of years ago. I think that's very healthy. I'm like a big proponent that until you have a like fully working company where you kind of understand like, okay, when I do this, I acquire more users and they pay me about this amount of money. Like you want to be like a two pizza team. Like you don't want to be more than eight people. You want to be like relatively technical. You want to all be sitting together. You want to be spending a ton of time with customers. You don't want to deal with any of the overhead that comes from having a large org and like the increased complexity of communication. So yeah, I think we're seeing more lean teams. I think that's really positive. I don't know if it will necessarily, the businesses I invest in, because they tend to have a lot of complex infrastructure, don't necessarily sway towards bootstrapping a lot of the time, just because they know they're going to need a couple years to build what they want to build. I do think there are a lot of founders who kind of think like, oh, I should raise money, but are not necessarily working in a market that is like a venture scale market. And in that case, I think it's very healthy to like maybe raise a small amount of angel money or maybe bootstrap or maybe think about like small business loans and kind of figure out a different economic model that gets you to profitability. And I think you can build very rewarding businesses that way. There's like the only reason venture capitalists don't back them is because like the economic model for VCs is different. It doesn't mean founders shouldn't build them.
There's plenty of great entrepreneurs out there that have built companies that have been acquired at great multiples. That is a great outcome for the entrepreneur.
Yeah.
Right.
And that's great.
It doesn't have to be venture
funded.
I'm
all for entrepreneurs having great outcomes for themselves.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And so recently I had Elizabeth Lawler on the podcast, and I think she's a good example of a founder who thinks the way you think of, you know, she's been building AppMap for a while and, you know, raising enough capital to keep a small team building what they're doing. And it's just, you know, she did that before with Conjure, which, you know, was acquired by CyberArk, and it was a great outcome for all. And, but it's not like they raised $100 million in funding, and, you know, it was just a very, you know, focus on a lean team, great market, getting developer adoption and scaling over time, but not like, you know, full throttle. We're going to raise, you know, growth round and crush the market. So, one of the things I noticed, like you're going to like, by the time this airs, this probably already went by, but you're speaking at a Boston Startup Week event, for pitch advice. So like you get pitched all the time. So what advice would you have for entrepreneurs on pitching a company?
Yeah. I think the biggest piece of advice I always have is remembering that the investor has a bunch of context too. And so when you're pitching, it's not like every investor is the same. And I know it can kind of seem like it from the founder side. It definitely took me a long time to figure it out. But like, if you're talking to me, you don't need to explain to me what an API is and why it matters. Like I'm with you 100% all about the APIs. But you do need to explain like the nuances of the approach. And so I think there's like a huge amount that pitches go better when the founder kind of like really dials into who they're talking to and why, and how they think that person can be valuable to them and how they can have the most interesting conversation there. So that's one part of it. I think the other part is remember that it's a conversation you're driving and you want to help make sure you get through all of the topics that you want to cover with that investor, but it's not necessarily a monologue and it's not necessarily you need to say everything. So you kind of want to be responding to cues as well. It's a conversation that you are driving. And I would definitely think about it in that order.
Got it. Okay. Broadly speaking, like the Boston tech ecosystem, what's the vibe right now? Like what are you seeing?
I feel like so much more is happening. I feel like people are like I'm excited about this pitch event that will be done by the time we air. I think that's like a great kind of thing. I think the work that Steph is doing with the Boston startup community is great. I've definitely been hearing from more people who are kind of like putting together more small dinners on themes, which has been great. I feel like also will have already happened by the time this airs, but like Mass Challenge has their big Revolve event that's happening. Like I just feel like I moved back in 2020 and things were pretty quiet for obvious reasons. And it like took a little bit of time to rebound. I kind of feel like I lived 2020 parts one through four, and like 2024, like everyone's out here, everyone's starting new companies, everyone's doing events. And I feel like there's like a lot of energy right now in our ecosystem.
Yeah, I agree. And it's good. It's great. It feels great to see people getting together again. Like I was at the New England Venture Capital Association NEVI Awards, and it was just such a great environment. There's so many people that I was able to catch up with that I hadn't seen in person in a long time. So it's just great to have that buzz again. And people are craving it. Like I talk to people that are, you know, exploring new job opportunities, and the common theme that I hear is just I feel unnetworked. Like I, you know, because I could do an online event and get great, you know, information from that, whatever the topic is, but I don't meet anybody. So that, you know, that personal connection of networking is something that people miss. And there seems to be an appetite, which is good.
Yeah.
All right. What are three apps you can't live without?
Oh, that's a hard one. This is like the lightning round. Obsidian is definitely a big one for me. If people haven't used it before, you can kind of think of it as like extremely complicated Notion, or like Rome. It's a note-taking application that's all Markdown based. You can have backlinks to analyze your information together. And then it also is like a super robust plugin ecosystem. So that definitely is a huge one for me. Also give you Arc, which is a new browser from the browser company. They are like very much on the cutting edge of browsers. There's some nice UX tweaks, but they also new have functionality where if you say, I want to open a bunch of like restaurant reservation pages, you can just type the query in once and it will open all those tabs for you at once. So it can like really shorten the amount of time you're doing research. So that is definitely one of my go-tos. And then I would say Raycast. This is a lot of like personal productivity stuff, but hopefully people like at least one of the three. And so Raycast is a replacement for the Mac Spotlight, but you can install applications directly into that.
Got it. Okay.
Ooh, can I have a fourth?
You can have a fourth guy.
But I'm thinking about it. Super Whisper. If you at all prefer, I sprained my thumb recently, and so typing wasn't as easy. But if you want to do audio dictation, it is an audio dictation tool that sits on top of the open source or the proprietary voice to text models. And then you can also prompt it with the structure. And so you can have it respond with different text. If you say, hey, I'm dictating an email compared to, hey, I'm dictating a journal entry compared to, hey, I'm dictating a memo for myself. And it's a super helpful way to turn audio content into structured documents.
Interesting. It just made me think of something personal that I don't know why, but maybe I'm just getting older and it's a fact of reality. My typing on my iPhone is terrible now. I don't know why I'm so bad. I'm like, shouldn't I be getting better at this? But it's just more like frustrating and annoying that I'm like, I don't know. I'm just, maybe I need to go, you know, and do the more text to speech type of thing. So, or speech to text, I mean. All right. How about a good podcast book recommendation?
Ooh. Okay, this is like slightly self-serving, but my partner Shomek has a podcast called Software Snack Bites, and he interviews some of the best people in enterprise technology. Like some of them are actually tech people, some of them are CROs, but I always learn something I did not know anything about, and he has a real talent for finding people who are kind of under the radar, but super interesting.
Okay, last question. What do you like to do for fun outside of work?
Well, I have a one-year-old, so I now between work and one-year-old don't have that much time for other stuff, but I am still doing triathlons. So I'm currently training for my first half Ironman.
Wow. That is amazing. That's a commitment.
It is a big commitment. I learned I'm going to start ramping up next week, and my short workouts are already an hour and my long workouts are already over two. And so ramp up seems like a lot. So we'll see how I make it work.
I think I could handle the running and biking. The swim would eat me alive. Like swimming in water with a bunch of people trying to get ahead of me, and I would drown and like be like, save me.
We had a swim coach we were working with for a little bit, and he was like, yeah, you want to put your goggles under your cap, so if someone kicks you in your face, the goggles don't fly off. And I was like, I think you're more competitive than I am. I'm like not trying to get that close to somebody's feet.
Yeah. No, that's the part where I'd just be like, okay. But that's great. That's awesome. Yeah. No, I have friends that have done that. So that's a, it's a commitment. So
you should,
kudos
you
to you.
If you can do running and biking.
I'm good. I like doing a nice 5-mile run, but outside of that, like, I don't know, I'm good.
Fair enough. So.
Yeah. All right, Ellen. Well, thanks so much for taking the time to walk us through your background story. Obviously, all the great work you've done as an entrepreneur, product manager, and now an investor.
Yeah, and I hope I'll get to see you at a local Boston event soon. We can hang out in person.
Definitely going to happen.